Welcome to Come and See, your podcast for finding truth in a world of chaos. Brought to you by Living Waters Abide Ministries. With host and founder, Richard Case, and co-host and retreat leader, Kathy Riccone. Jesus reminds us to watch for the signs of his return. Today, we will explore further what we are seeing in our times that line up with what signs he said would indicate the potential of the end and his return. We will also discuss the practical meaning of this as we watch and as a remnant prepare as he so leads. And now your host, Richard Case.
Well, good morning, everybody. This is our End Times Friday, and we have our special guest, Eric and Rabbi Ephraim from Israel. I think you both are in Jerusalem, right? Are you in Jerusalem, Ephraim?
We are. Yeah, we're both here.
Yeah. And lots going on since our last conversation. We have a slightly new format on our End Times. Kathy, as you know, was a co-host, and she's a co-host on my regular podcast, but she needed a little bit more time for her kids and grandkids now. And so Denny Weinberg is going to be my official co-host on Fridays. So that'll be fun. Denny, welcome and thanks. And
thank you, Rich. So great to be here again anyway.
Yes. And we have lots and lots to talk about with what's going on in Israel. So why don't you go ahead and start the discussion?
Well, one of the questions that I had for Eric and for Ephraim is around the attention that the Middle East has moved from in the United States and perhaps throughout the rest of the world. And some of this is just natural things taking center stage, but it's interesting to me how this has dissipated as a point of a lot of media attention and a lot of discussion.
You know, I think our view from here is that it's nice to have the quiet for a while. And I think it's also our view from here that without images and headlines propagating lies about Israel regarding so-called genocide and starvation, whatever, without the accompanying photographs, many of which are fake, that it doesn't attract the news anymore. And it's no longer that's what's going on. It's not saying that there isn't some level of fighting going on in Gaza, as there is some level of fighting going on, but it's much smaller in scope and nature. And so, there are other issues in the world taking attention now. And pretty soon, China may be dominating the news in the world if, you know, things don't go the right way here soon. And that's, I think that's our view, Ephraim. I don't know.
Yeah, I'll echo that for the most part, it's really good when we don't have the world's attention upon us, because almost always it's going to be negative about Israel. So, you know, every time somebody would get injured or killed in Gaza because there was a war going on, it would be splashed across headlines. And if there's a terror attack inside Israel, it usually doesn't get any attention. And there definitely have been a number of terror attacks. There's also been all sorts of breaches of the ceasefire, which I don't believe get picked up over there, but which leads people to, this is like sort of, a negative side of no attention is, but in general, the only attention that Israel normally gets is what makes Israel look bad in the media. So it's good when we don't get any attention. We don't even hope to get attention to the things that are of concern to us. So for example, now there's the Hamas has been breaking the ceasefire left and right, with both attacking, armed attacks against Israeli soldiers, not returning hostages that they killed. And then when Israel does, a breach or counteracts and a Hamas terrorist gets killed, that might get hit the headlines. But that's an important thing for people to know that doesn't get across to Americans for the most part. Same thing in Lebanon, Hezbollah also. You don't hear about all the breaches of the ceasefire that's going on in Lebanon, but as long as Israel does retaliate, that will hit the headlines.
I think what maybe your listeners should understand is that there has been a shift in policy in the IDF as a result of October 7th. In Judea and Samaria, the IDF preemptively, through its really vast intelligence network, learns about imminent attacks not 100% of the time, but a high percentage of the time before it actually happens. It's interesting. I'm really involved with the lone soldiers, and there was a lone soldier from Australia who I was driving back and forth from Tel Aviv a number of times. He served in a unit called Duv Devan, which this unit is a special forces unit. He's not in it anymore. He got discharged. That goes into cities and villages in the Arab sectors of Judea and Samaria at any time of the day or night, and goes in to arrest somebody or to confiscate what they believe are arms. And so I asked him several times, you know, does he ever like lose sleep at night feeling bad about pounding down the door of some Arab family in the middle of the night, 2 o'clock in the morning, barging into their home and rustling up the entire family? And he says, nope. And I was really surprised to hear the answer, because he's a really, you know, normal guy. And he said, because 99.9 times out of 100, we find exactly what we're told we're going to find, exactly where and exactly what quantities. Mm. And so he says the intelligence is so good. So coming back to my original premise, I think the IDF's new sort of strategy, I'm not sure it's a strategy or tactic, is maybe a better word, is to not permit, once again, the enemy to build up to a point where they can launch a severe attack. So, you know, Lebanese government or no Lebanese government, the IDF is going in and it's going to be taking out. It was actually refraining for a while, because for a while, the Lebanese army was making progress in disarming and taking over southern Lebanon. But things have slowed down and stopped. And so the IDF is taking over. And right now, Lebanon is not getting a lot of sympathy from the United States and most of the West, because they've shirked their responsibilities in trying to disarm. It's been their big opportunity to take back their country, but they're not doing it. And likewise in Gaza, what Ephraim was referring to, there have been a few incidents. I would say what's been reported in the Israeli press at the rate of 2 to 3 per week, not more, where some Hamas single person or a group tries to infiltrate what has now become known as the Yellow Line. This is the demarcation line through which the IDF evacuated Gaza. So this is their way of trying to perpetrate some attack and get away with it. So in one attack that happened soon after the ceasefire, I think 2 or 3 Israelis were actually killed. But since then, I'm not aware of any Israelis being killed. And more often than not, the Hamas attackers get neutralized. And then there was an incident, quite interesting one, last week. I don't know if your listeners have heard, there are these tunnels under the portion of Gaza that the IDF now administers. There are a few tunnels, I don't know how many, still in the southern part of Gaza intact. And inside those tunnels, it was estimated that there were 200 Hamas fighters that Hamas was demanding that, as a part of the ceasefire, Israel release. And I mean, it's almost getting laughs here in Israel. There's no way this government could survive and just release terrorists who were responsible for killing Israelis through their own accord. There's no way that was going to happen. So what was offered was, well, they can either give up and be arrested, or they can come out and fight and we'll kill them. And that was becoming a big point of contention. But one group out of the tunnels, I'm told there were 3, around 17 of the Hamas fighters emerged out of the tunnel, and about 8 gave up and the rest refused and they were killed. And it now appears there are roughly 80 fighters underground. And at some point, they'll run out of food, they'll come up, and something will happen.
We did hear just a couple of days ago that they found a major, what they called a vital, fundamental set of tunnels that fed all these peripheral ones that was very lengthy, and they supposedly destroyed it all. Or is it destroyed?
First of all, there aren't enough explosives in the world to blow up all the tunnels. Okay. That's just how massive they are. I'm serious. So they have to be selective. Some tunnels they just filled with concrete. Okay. And other tunnels they've blown up. And I don't know the criteria for which they decided what to do with which ones. And some they probably leave intact because they're not deemed to be really significant, any significant danger. I don't know. But they have some system by which they decide these things.
Yeah. They were reported here that it was like a main thoroughfare tunnel that fed everything down there, and they discovered it and took care of it.
Yeah.
So as we look at Gaza, particularly, and, northern in Lebanon and Hezbollah, would you characterize it as having fulfilled what they did by pushing them back and now weakening them? Not they haven't destroyed them, but weakened them. That their posture is just to maintain that they remain weak and not allow them to gain a lot of strength again.
Look, we're dealing with I'll use the word fanatic movements that glorify death. There was an interview on Israeli TV of an Arab father whose son, he lives in, I think, Syria, and his son was killed after trying to attack Israeli soldiers. And he was telling the interviewer how proud he was that now he can go to heaven and he has a place in heaven because his son died a martyr. So this is the mentality of a society that's been indoctrinated over the years here. And by the way, there are signs that there are other parts of the United States that are getting indoctrinated this way also, which we can talk about if you like. But, and so, look, no matter how many machine guns or F-35s we have, we're never going to obliviate this movement and this philosophy, as evil as it is. And so to say we're going to destroy Hamas, I don't think that needs, you know, despite the prime minister having used those words, I don't think that one can take that literally. All one can do is get them so that their military capacity is virtually eradicated and their ability to govern is gone, and make it very hard for them to build up the capacity to attack again for many, many, many years. And that's the philosophy that the IDF is putting into place now on the northern border and as well as on the border with Gaza. I don't think it's been talked about in the Western press, but, you know, there's a budget been allocated and it's under construction now. We're building a pretty high security fence now along our border with Jordan because the relations between the Jordanian people and the Israeli people is good. I think it's pretty bad. But the Hashemite kingdom, that is the king of Jordan, sees the benefit of having a peace treaty with Israel and for his country. And so he maintains it. But it's a fragile government, very fragile. And in fact, if it weren't for Israel, it would have been overthrown some years ago. And so we're building a border there to try to prevent smuggling of arms and people across the border.
I was going to say, all the focus on Hamas over the last couple of years that seems to have come to a head over this agreement or this possible agreement. And the fact that what's reported here is that even though it's tenuous and there's, you know, accusations of violations and all of that, it is still sort of in play. And what's your thoughts about, you know, is that really true? Does phase one ever end? Does phase two ever begin?
Look, I haven't read all the details, so maybe Ephraim has. I've listened to... TV interviews with people who on the know understand the details and so on. So the first phase is not complete yet. As Ephraim alluded to, there are still three dead Israeli hostages whose bodies have yet to be returned. There's some disagreement on whether Hamas really knows where they are or not. And if they pretend to be digging up the ground to look for them, I don't know. But they had agreed to return them all, and they still haven't lived up to that agreement. And those poor families it's very difficult. I think most of your Christian community will understand. I mean, for an Israeli family to be living without being able to bury the body, it's really hard. It's a very traumatic situation. Not as traumatic as knowing that your loved ones in some tunnel in Gaza being starved and sexually tortured, but it's still very difficult. So the second phase is it calls for Hamas to disarm. And that's the process. And along with that, Israel's supposed to withdraw its troops to another zone. But I don't think you can find more than five Israelis you can count on one hand in our entire country that believe we're going to get to that point, because no one here believes that Hamas will ever disarm willingly, because it's just against their philosophical makeup. It's like putting a gun to their head, which I guess they kind of do. But
they've actually come out and said, I think the last few days or last week, that wasn't part of the agreement. We never agreed that we were going to disarm, even though obviously they did. But none of this comes as any surprise to people in Israel. Trump presented it as this rosy utopian scenario that everything is now hunky-dory, and no one here really had much confidence in that.
Well, I'm not sure how much Trump really believed it was all going to happen quite that way either, but who really knows?
Yeah. So first of all, as Eric mentioned, the idea that they will disarm, they're showing absolutely, not just zero, but they're showing the exact opposite. They've taken advantage of the ceasefire to come out of their tunnels, to kill anyone who's any type of opposition to them. If there are clans that are not affiliated with Hamas that have any type of arms.
Other guys and Arabs.
Other guys, thank you. Yeah, that they've killed their Arab Muslim opposition to consolidate their power over the whole area that they still control. And they continue to do attacks against Israeli soldiers, and they say they're not going to disarm. So we don't see much hope in that area. And then even if there was some movement in that area, then the idea of other countries that supposedly are come in as peacekeepers, we also have very little confidence in that, because any other countries really going to come in and risk their lives to eliminate Hamas terrorists and arms? I mean, these are scary, violent people that don't want anyone in their way. And you see how hard it has been for Israel to try and weaken Hamas. And we have a lot of reason to be motivated to do that. But if you're like a peacekeeper from Finland, or even more hysterically funny, from Turkey, then, you know, really, you're going to risk your life to kill a Hamas terrorist? This peacekeeping force doesn't sound at all a realistic proposal, because Hamas has no intention of allowing people to...
Under that scenario, will IDF be able, for both Hezbollah and Hamas, just continue to operate so that they don't gain a lot? I mean, they're going to be there. They're going to continue to attack. Will they be able to minimize their ability to attack, because they won't let them get large enough anymore, or to a point where they'll be able to have a large-scale attack against Israel?
That's such a good question. I hope Eric has more clarity on this. I will just say that in the past, peacekeeping forces, if the situation is like now, where it's just like us versus Hamas, it looks like Israel's new policy, as opposed to past times when there were ceasefires and supposed peace agreements, we sort of ended up having international pressure on us, that even though the other side would send rockets at us or kill us or shoot us, we were still under pressure to maintain the ceasefire, maintain the quiet, so we wouldn't react. It looks like Israel has changed that policy and is determined to eliminate it. However, if Gaza gets filled up with international peacekeepers from all sorts of other countries, that becomes really difficult to do. And you know, in the same way as southern Lebanon was full of international peacekeepers, and then it became really hard for us to eliminate Hezbollah terrorists, because you can't hurt an international peacekeeper who are sitting right on top of the Hezbollah missiles that they're supposed to be preventing from being there in the first place.
Doesn't that suggest that the current moment, where it's very difficult for much of a media movement that's anti-Israel because Israel has done something, you know, allegedly bad in these very recent weeks. Everything you're talking about, even though it's not being widely reported, are all about violations by Hamas. Is this worldwide view that the poor Palestinians are being butchered a point that can no longer be made, and that is a favorable position for Israel?
Well, if it is, then it's very temporary, because they'll find a way to make themselves victims, because that's what they do best. So you know, and it's the, you know, we had rains, very heavy rains, even though it's been a dry season about, what was it, 2 weeks ago, Ephraim, I forget.
Yeah.
And they were showing images of tents being flooded in Gaza, which was very predictable. I mean, that's what I was saying to, you know, family members, that, you know, wait till the rainy season starts. See, people, their tents aren't going to hold up so well. And so all these temporary living conditions are going to be seen as being very inadequate. And so I believe that what will happen with time, given what we've talked about so far, is an attempt, whether it's successful or not, I don't know, an attempt to enable some of the clans. That these clans are like very extended families within the Palestinian Arab community. It could be as large as, you know, 25, 30,000 50,000 people, cousins and so on of cousins. And that is, they begin to take over their own policing capabilities and doing the local law enforcement, if you will, and the judicial, and Israel providing sort of a peripheral security and allowing some of the Gazan residents to return to this enclave surrounded by the IDF and show how it's possible to rebuild homes. And the thinking, whether it's successful or not, I don't know, I think, is that if you can show some of them living in normal conditions with a roof over their head, something other than canvas, that it'll encourage others to say, well, why is this situation with Hamas being tolerated? But I think that's the current thinking, even with the American administrations. That's the most logical path to go, because as Ephraim said, and Saudi Arabia said it publicly, and Jordan has said it publicly, and Egypt has said it publicly, and Azerbaijan, which is actually a fairly intermediary country, because Israel has good relations with Azerbaijan, as an example, and it's a Muslim country. It borders on Iran and Armenia. And all these countries, which are Muslim countries, have said there is no way we're sending any troops into Gaza to help this effort if Hamas is still armed. They've said it point blank, because they understand the dynamics. They know what they're getting into.
Well, that's a great start. We're going to continue this for our next session. We'd like to come back and visit this whole discussion about the ceasefire, the Abraham Accord, Saudi Arabia. Mm-hmm. You know, where is this all going, particularly with America, you know, kind of playing with Saudi Arabia, who has stated, and this is what we're hearing, and we'll talk about this next time, that they would like to pursue that, but it has to be with a Palestinian state established. So we have to understand from your perspective, you know, what exactly does that mean, and what's the perspective, you know, from Israel. So thank you so much for sharing on this in this first session, Denny. Thanks so much for co-hosting and, you know, providing your leadership with it. We welcome everybody that if you have questions, send them in at questions@abideministry.com, and you can address it to any of the three or all three. We'd love to answer those questions for you as you consider the impact of what's going on, and we look forward to our next session coming up to talk about these broader things. So thank you so much, guys, for doing that.
Thank you for joining us for today's episode of Come and See, your podcast for truth in a world of chaos. Brought to you by Living Waters Abide Ministries. Send us your questions and comments and tune in tomorrow for more answers to your personal questions about living life in God's truth. Remember, God's will is best and none better. His truth brings peace in this world of chaos.